teaching, mentoring, and inspiring countless people around the world by focusing on everything from effective marketing and leadership to the spread of ideas and changing everything, Seth Godin is making a ruckus. Are you inspired to make a ruckus of any kind? Then this is the podcast for you. Seth's daily blogs guide us to do things like making sure we're on the right bus and explains that once we commit, once we engage, we have to commit to ship. He helps people to get their ideas to spread and to make sure they know what they are tracking is the right thing to be tracking. He asks provocative questions like, are you in a race to the bottom or a climb to the top? How did you change? Who trusts you? Who did you change? Who would miss you if you were gone? He makes you think about if your idea is profitable, difficult, or important. In simple terms, he doesn't tell you what to think. He just wants you to. Come think with us so we can be together for a bit and put our thinking caps on. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for being a part of it. As many of you know, my journey as Mrs. Green started over 10 years ago when I returned from a trip to the Amazon rainforest. It was obviously transformative, life-changing, and scary as heck. I was determined to start a radio show to spread the word about the biggest threat our planet has ever faced, climate change. As terrified as I was, my visit there touched me so deeply that I knew all the tools I would need would move forward. They'd come with me. They'd start showing up. And I would become a national media company. And indeed, they have. One of the first things that showed up came in the form of advice from my brother, who simply told me, you have to read Tribes by Seth Godin and subscribe to his blog. I listened to him. Indeed, I did. And I can tell you from the bottom of my very green heart that I sincerely believe that the Mrs. Green's World movement wouldn't be where we are today without the everyday wisdom of Seth Godin. The reason? From the outset, Tribes changed my intention from wanting to build an audience to wanting to start a movement, to bring together a tribe of like-minded people and do amazing things. And indeed, that's just what the Mrs. Green's World team has done and why we keep on doing it. It's not easy, but somehow you always know it's better. How blessed am I that I'm actually getting to spend time with Seth Godin for a bit, as you are, and probe a little bit deeper into that content-rich brain and spectacular brain. So please join me in welcoming Seth Godin, visionary thought leader, prolific author, and extraordinary human being. Seth, can you tell I'm excited to have you here, yes or no?
Well, almost as excited as I am to be here. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Okay, from the bottom of my heart, so let's get to it. Race to the bottom or climb to the top for those of us who are engaged in the business of change. What are some of the concepts that we need to understand to decide if we're racing to the bottom or climbing to the top?
Well, you know, there's so many examples we can give. If you were running a newspaper and you put garish, violent photos on the front page and push for armed conflict, you'll sell more papers in the short run. That's a race to the bottom. It says, how do I attract people who are indulging in their base instinct? How do I have a short, quick thrill for them? On the other hand, if you want to put together a journal, a thoughtful periodical with smart writing from smart people that's going to be read by people who care, your newsstand sales are going to be really low at the beginning. And it might take months or years to get to the point where you're resonating with a group of people big enough to make a difference. That's a race to the top. The same thing's true when we talk about things we sell or ideas we want to spread. We have choices. And the thing that feels easy in the short run might not get you to where you want to go.
So we want to change people's behaviors, which there are days when I think that's one of the most challenging things that we could ever have set out to do. It's not like selling reusable bottles or getting more likes on Facebook. Sometimes it's challenging to answer that question. So what are some of the things to put in our thought process about if we're even on the right path? I mean, you very clearly say you don't pay attention to likes. You don't care who retweets you. You just show up. Does that hold true for almost whatever you're doing? If you're staying true to that intention and know clearly what changes you'd like to see come about, just stay focused?
Well, it's really important that we begin with the audience. The chances that anyone, including you, is going to change someone whose identity is wrapped up in something that is diametrically opposed, the chances that you can make a butcher into a vegan are very, very low.
Right.
And is this not worth the time to go directly to the most infuriating people in the community and try to change them? It doesn't work. And this is the mistake so many activists make, is they make two mistakes. Mistake number one is they find the worst offender and try to change them. And mistake number two is they find someone who seems sympathetic to the cause, but they say you're not good enough. And both of those are mistakes for different reasons. So we begin by saying, what's the smallest group of people that if I made an impact on them, it would be enough? And if I can delight and inspire and move that small group of people, will they tell their friends? Because you don't get a butcher to become a vegan, but the butcher's friends might be able to get him to become a vegan. And that's how the culture changes. It changes from the grassroots. It changes person to person. And, you know, the challenge that we have, if we're going to try to change the culture in a significant way, as you are seeking to do, is to find people who are predisposed to want to listen to us, who are enrolled in learning from us, and thirdly, who will become evangelical in getting the others.
And what you say about just keep showing up, ship, whatever. The thing that I've learned from that and by rereading things that you've written is you never know when that's happened, or sometimes you know. And I'll give you an example of where it was like a Seth moment. I got a LinkedIn comment from someone who said, I'm using your podcast at Biosphere 2 for my students. And it's like, bam, bingo.
You
know what I mean? It's like you're not doing it for that. But the most important thing is that you keep showing up, and then people that you described find you. And it's not a metric, it's an experience, which is, you know, so much better. What about when it comes to regulations? And another thing that you wrote, are you working against regulations? And the blog said, the reason we need the FDA, which is certainly one of my hot topics these days, states that smart, ethical marketers understand that regulation actually helps them do their work, because in a competitive environment in which some marketers are rewarded for the short-term hit, the race to the bottom is inevitable. So any top of mind, when I read that, I thought, who is Seth thinking about in terms of smart, ethical marketers that are being what we call disruptors for good? Top of mind, because examples are great for us to build on.
Well, so let's say you have a dog food company. It seems to me that the fact that there are government agencies that won't let adulterated dog food from overseas come into our market is good for you, because if they were allowed in, you'd have to race with them to make ever cheaper, lousier products. So regulation is actually helping someone like Purina, because they're self-regulating.
Right.
And if someone is self-regulating, you want your competition to also be regulated. And it gives you something to lean against. You say, oh, no, we're going to have this conversation about putting plastic in our dog food because it's not allowed. So we don't have to have the conversation. And I think that capitalism has gotten out of hand in the sense that if the public markets are pushing you to make every single possible penny in profit, you make short-term decisions when you're lobbying because you think that's the only way to win is by changing the game. And my argument is the game actually helps us do our work. Now, in the case of a movement like the one surrounding climate change, what we need in place is a ratchet so that it will get better on a regular basis. A simple example is it didn't used to be required to tell people what the mileage for a car was. And by making it a requirement, so you have to say what the mileage is, that doesn't cost anybody anything in year one. So what happens by year three is people are competing on that axis. And it's only because you can compete on that axis that you can end up with a plug-in Prius because if no one knew that the plug-in Prius got 150 miles to the gallon, no one would buy it. And so figuring out how to put in place regimes around cap and trade and around efficiency so that there's transparency will create an environment where competitors will keep pushing each other to go more and more in the right direction.
So when you're a ruckus maker for the planet and you see things that are happening with the FDA, it's a perfect example, and you wrote it before all of these, you know, weakening of the regulations came out. What I see is just what you said. The ethical, moral people and a lot of government leaders are saying, who cares what the FDA said? We want to have a healthy, sustainable, and socially just community. But then there's the other guys, the guys that put plastic in their dog food, that are they're doing the happy dance. So then how do you put pressure back on that? Because we do need those FDA regulations for our air, for our water, for the food we eat. And what I see is the, you know, the effort to dismantle it. And it makes me have a lot of fear around what people don't know and what they don't understand in terms of the harmful ripple effects when those regulations are dramatically diluted. So when do you like raise the ruckus even louder?
Well, here's what we know about humans. Humans are not swayed by peer-reviewed statistics. They are swayed by stories. They're swayed by visual, emotional stories. That is how we make decisions about winning the lottery. It's how we make decisions about what school to send our kid to, what college they should go to. It's deep ingrained into who we are. You know, as you and I are talking about this right now, there's been a lot of media coverage about the journalist who was killed in Saudi Arabia.
Right, right.
Saudi Arabia. Well, in the amount of time that that controversy has been going on, hundreds or thousands of people have been killed in Yemen. But they don't have a story.
So
this
true.
Guy has a story. And so what we need to do, and I grew up 10 miles from the Love Canal in the 1970s. The Love Canal, the young woman who brought it to the forefront and the families that she organized, she turned a fact into a true story. And it was a true story about this could have happened anywhere. It was a true story about lying. It was a true story about fear of the future. And we need to do a better job of becoming really clear with no ifs and no maybes about what is happening right now that's vivid. It's not that 100 woodpeckers are going to die. It's that a woodpecker named Woody, here he is going to die in the next 3 weeks. We're going to watch Woody die because he doesn't have a habitat. That's a story. It's still true that all the woodpeckers in that field are going to die, but we need to hang it on something that people can resonate with.
And the person, like you're telling this story, the person that pops into my mind, who's one of the most recognizable human beings on the planet, is Jane Goodall. And I've gotten to meet her. I've gotten to interview her. I heard her speak at the Global Climate Action Summit. And to your point, guess what she does? She tells
yeah.
stories about her relationship with all of those animals, and even her movie, Jane. It's about her story. So I agree. And these conferences I'm going to, it has become so much more about telling the story because that's what touches people's hearts. And it cracks me up when people, like if we do events, they want to meet Mrs. Green. They don't want to see what our handouts are, you know, because they like my story. So let's talk.
I just want to put a pin in this for a second, right?
Put a pin.
So Jane Goodall is a saint and she should win a Nobel Prize, but Jane Goodall is a hero. And the problem with being
True.
A hero is now it's somebody else's job. And it's very difficult to make Jane Goodall's story our story. And
yeah, right.
You, on the other hand, are doing that with your work. And so in order for it to become evangelical, it can't be, let me tell you about this person in the jungle who's doing amazing things. It's, let me tell you about me. Let me tell you about us. That gives the story legs.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And weaving that in, the imprint that she's had on me, and making it my story. You're absolutely right. And it never ceases to amaze me. So thank you for that. One of the blogs that I just keep them, you know, we have this expression around our team, WWSS, what would Seth say?
Oh, no.
And it's good. No, it's really good. It's really good because, and the other thing I wanted to say about Jane Goodall and about you and about all of these other amazing people I met, they're not out there ever. Jane Goodall could care less that I'm a fan. In the sense that, yeah, that's great. What are you going to do about it? They don't care about the praise and the lights and the, you know, the conference I was at in San Francisco. She and Dave Matthews were like fooling around on the stage. It was hysterical. And I thought, that's Jane Goodall. No pomp, no circumstance, no makeup, no lipstick. You know, there she is just showing up. Talk about a hero. So let's shift to talking on getting on the right bus. Because it's like sometimes the quintessence of the question, deciding carefully. We're doing our next 10-year plan, which I think at 68 is pretty damned impressive that I'm sitting there with my team and saying, you guys, by the time we execute this, I'll be 78. Game on. But you have to carefully decide what projects you're engage with, because once you engage, you're committed to ship it. And we're about to ship a big one. You're always about to ship a big one. I'd like to read the blog because it's really short. Your first mistake was getting on the A53 bus, the one that goes crosstown instead of to where you're going. Mistakes like this happen all the time. The big mistake, though, the one that will cost you, is staying on that bus. I know it wasn't easy to get on the bus. I know you got a seat. I know it's getting dark outside, but you're on the wrong bus, and staying on the wrong bus won't make it the right bus. If you really want to get to where you set out to go, you're going to have to get off the wrong bus. So, my comment. There are days when I do think I'm on the wrong bus, and your blogs make me think about things like this. I don't have enough followers. We aren't making enough money. The planet isn't preserved yet. All those monsters that you call the lizard brain start working overtime. They come out at night. Sometimes they come out in the day. Is there an answer to how do you know you're on the wrong bus? Is there an answer to that? If statistics don't change minds, what does?
Well, there's a question inside a question inside a question.
I'm really good at that, so take your time.
No, you're doing great. The purpose of the post was to say there are demonstrably wrong buses. You know, so you went to law school, and 2 years into being a lawyer, you realize not only are there no good jobs coming up, but you hate being a lawyer. So it's not, you're not wondering if you're on the wrong bus. It's just the sunk costs are keeping you on the wrong bus. And so that's where I'm headed there. But I think the bigger question is, how big and how audacious should a movement's plans be? Should its tactics be? Should its 10-year plan be? So, you know, when the Reverend King in 1963 or whatever said that he could envision a world where people wouldn't be judged by the color of their skin, he was enough of a realist to leave out the part that says, and it's probably not going to happen in the next 10 years, but we're going to head toward that. Okay, fine. So if we're heading toward that, where are we going to be in 2 years or 4 years? And the answer is not, we'll be done. The answer is we will go from 10,000 people in the movement to 200,000 people in the movement. And we know people have built movements with the resources we have at that scale before. So we know it's doable. And that's the key part, is that too often movements get hung up because they have the big shining goal and they're not willing to settle for anything between here and there. And so it's all the way to the end or bust, but all the way to the end is a really long time in the future. The alternative is to get really clear about which groups of people will be changed in which way, in which period of time, and to do that in a deliberate fashion.
So when you are in this space of questioning, to me, what I come back to is intention. Is what I am doing aligned with our intention? And from when we started, it's never changed. Two things: we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And then to provide provocative, important things for people to think about and hopefully then change their behaviors. So when I do that exercise, I think, what is my intention here? Is it to increase revenue? Is it to change more minds? Is it to raise the consciousness? And sometimes the answer should be yes to all of those. But to me, if you set a clear intention, which Tribes helps you do, and you should read it every 5 years, because what are you doing? Are you building a tribe or you're growing an audience? And to me, those are very different things. You should always want to be growing your tribe and finding people that are going to get on the bus with you. Okay, are you being a jerk? Sometimes I just laugh at your blogs, and it's a time when I need laughter. The jerk fallacy states that for every person who has a reputation as a bully, a deal breaker, an intimidator, press pause, who am I thinking about? Someone who fights for every scrap. There are many people who succeeded by weaving together disparate communities, by keeping their word, by quietly creating value. Both roads can work. The presence of jerks at the top, and I'm sorry that I'm laughing, confirm this, and so does the predominance of good folks. The problem with the jerk path is not that it isn't more effective, it's that you have to spend your days being a jerk. So to be honest, the first question when I read that was, I wonder who's reading Seth's blog in Washington, D.C. these days. Unanswerable, clearly. But how much does the press lead us to believe? I believe there's a predominance of good folks, amazing human beings doing the good thing, the right thing, and getting others to do the same. And part of that is because I immerse myself in that culture. I go to conferences that are the kumbaya for what I believe in, and I've opted out of watching network news because it doesn't inspire me in any way. It gets me upset. So what about shaping, like, in some ways, I say I am the press. I don't like to be called media. I want to be called a movement maker. What is the direction there in terms of keeping that thought that there's lots a predominance of good folks? How do we go there in these days when all you see on the news are jerks, fear-based, pretty much? Look for a different way to get your information. What's your thought? Is that 10 questions, well, or why, you get the question?
Why do we see it on the news so much? We see it on the news so much because the media doesn't care that much what they write. They care about getting seen. And many human beings want to see that story. They want to see that story because it lets them off the hook. It lets them off the hook because what we're not saying is the future is up to us. We're saying the future is not up to us. It's being held hostage by these people. And I think that the challenge you have in leading your tribe is to help remind people that it's not up to those people. It's up to us. And that we don't need an edict to solve this problem. We simply need 20 million people to insist that the problem gets solved, and it will. And in the new book, I spent a couple of pages talking about the NRA. And the reason I do is that the NRA, whether or not you agree with what they do, has fewer than 5 million members. And with fewer than 5 million members, they basically amended the Constitution of the United States without a vote, with only 5 million people. So the problem we have is not that there aren't enough people who concur about the urgency of the climate problem. The problem is that they are not organized, connected, passionate, persistent in the face of skepticism. Because if we were, then the problem would be addressed in ways that would get us moving forward. But instead, we wring our hands. We say, well, it's not our fault. Someone at the top isn't doing it.
It's so true. It's giving away our power. I say that all the time. Even when I left my big company, when everybody in the company thought I was leaving for all the right reasons, they thought my partner had the power and they were scared. And it's like, thank God that I left because I was supposed to be doing something else. But it goes back to what you said about getting on the right bus and inspiring others to do the same. Because to me, watching the news, you might want to think about if you were on the right bus. I mean, we went to a conference this past weekend, the Mrs. Green's World team, and somewhere in the middle of it, hearing these amazing speakers and what wonderful things are going on. Just like with Google Earth, we were like crazy about this woman who's telling us what we're being able to do about Google Earth. I looked at Meredith and Kelly and I said, you know, it's just not bothering me that I don't know what Stormy Daniels is up to when the tweets that are going on around it. It's like you felt relevant and engaged and on purpose. And to me, something we could all do is just turn it off. There's lots of really good things on television these days, nature specials and things that delight and inform. So it becomes like crack to people, and I can't see where the value is in it. And sometimes I feel stupid in a conversation at dinner when people bring something up. And then I just say, you know what? It's just not my thing. I'm working on some other stuff. So, okay. Another blog from Seth Godin. Summer's almost over. Well, the year's almost over. Perhaps one of the most bizarre years in my life, to say the least. So what are your thoughts on this little window of time that we have? Literally weeks. One that we'll never see again. From where you stand in this crazy, bizarre world, which it is this a great time to make a contribution and try to go out with a bang? Or from where you sit, might our time be better spent reflecting, asking ourselves, I want to know, was our work remarkable this year? Was it worth making a remark about? Was it original work? Was it what we wanted to get built and shared and done and embraced? How would you say we should end our year?
Well, you know, what Timothy Leary said, and I don't agree with much of the work Timothy Leary did as a chemist, but what Timothy Leary said when people at Harvard asked him what they should do next, he said, find the others. That if we simply find the others and create the connection and the energy that comes from that connection, and then those people also find the others, we will win elections and we will change policies and corporations will listen and consumption patterns will change. The mistake we are making is not that we're failing to get worked up. The mistake we're making is we're not doing a good job of finding the others.
Got it. I agree. And we did, you know, we assess, which I think is great. We look at, like, we launched this whole new, gorgeous newsletter format, and we're thrilled about it. So about a month ago, I said, you know, it's been out there enough. I'm glad we're thrilled about it. We're really happy. What is the tribe saying? And Seth, to your point, we got a report on it yesterday from one of the team members. The lead article, this is about your storytelling. The lead article that got the most opens was, my friend is dying. That is the number one highest ever open rate that we've ever had. And it was about a woman who told a story about her friend dying of cancer, and she was really too busy with her life to bring her lunch or do this or do that. Now she's so sick, they're, you know, in the final days. And the most wonderful thing to me is that she wrote about Mrs. Green and how it impacted her life and taking the time to read stuff like that. It was all beautiful when we found out about it, but it's telling a story. And then the second thing was, we do 5 calls to action. And people want to know what to do. They want to be led. They want to be helped. They want to be inspired. So the second highest thing, open rate on our newsletter, is we have 5 action steps that you can choose to do or not do or read about. So it's just another validation of show up and help inspire people to do the same and then tell others. And we keep showing up. It's like, yeah, some days I'm like, I hope people are looking. Okay, can you share with us a time when you got on the wrong bus and decided to get off?
Oh, I've been on the wrong bus many, many times. Literally today, this morning, I had an interview and I took the train into the city, leaving plenty of time. and there were no announcements, but the train didn't come. And all the commuters on the track are waiting because they've committed to taking the train to work today. But the train's now 5 minutes late, 10 minutes late, 15 minutes late. There's no data that shows that the train's ever going to come. So I said, this is the wrong track. And I got my Prius and I drove to the city because I had a thing I had to go to. And for all I know, there's still people waiting at the track. So that's not a metaphorical example. That's a literal example of being on the wrong track. But in terms of more metaphorical, you know, I've built web companies. The last one 6 years ago was the 35th biggest website in the United States. And we sold it. And the main reason we sold it was because I said, this works, but it's not what I want to do. And let me go do what I want to do instead, because I'm not going to get today over again.
Such, like, it was like taking an arrow into my heart. That's the 10-year plan with Mrs. Green's World, because some of the things that we're doing, I don't want to do anymore. And it is pace of the leader, pace of the team. So we're going to stay on the same bus in the same direction with the same intention, but expand that vision so that I can keep loving what I do. Because like I said, when I said to everybody, yeah, 10-year plan, 78 people, almost 80, I can do this. So right. Showing up and staying on it. And, you know, just a sidebar, total hard diversion here. I watched this unbelievable, I think it was on 60 Minutes, about the guy they've hired to change the subway system. You know, my first job was at 14 Wall Street. And talk about someone that I want to follow. And he said, people are fed up. People are tired. Yep. Things break down. And if there's any, I would back this man. I would bet on this horse because he is so inspirational and it's going to take time. And talk about being inconvenienced. And it's New Yorkers, no less. It's not like people right. in Kansas. It's like, oh, yeah, good luck with that. I hope you have some really thick skin. But he inspired me. And I thought, if anybody's going to get this job done, it's that guy. Okay.
Well, I hope so.
I do too. I mean, and it cracks me up that you brought it up because what do you do? And maybe someone didn't have a car to, you know, to drive into the city, but you have to have a plan B. So
right. I asked three people if they wanted a ride. They all said, no, it's just wait for the train.
No, it'll come. Yeah, well, I'd love to be able to know if it really did. I'm curious about, obviously, you think, you ponder, you plan, you show up every day. It's hard work. It's remarkable work. You don't just show up. It's really good. Everybody wants to read it if they're in the habit of, you know, like I do my morning, brush my teeth and all those other things. I meditate and then I read your blog and Martha Beck. So it's a perfect storm for me to get me started on the day. Are there times for you, and I've always wanted to ask you this, when something happens that's so remarkable enough that you change the plans and you write something else? And what's top of mind for me are the pipe bombings that are showing up in people's mailboxes. And the reason I ask that is because sometimes, and this is really sincere on my part, I want to know what you have to say about it because it helps steer my ship. You're a mentor for me, a guide for me. Do things happen that interfere with Seth's plan and how you show up differently on any particular day?
There are, but they're not like that because part of the discipline is I'm not a weatherman. I'm not trying to say something that's really useful now and obsolete in 12 hours. So the things that happen in the world and in the media certainly inform the way I think, and they inform how I feel about our future. But I relentlessly resist the temptation of using them to key into what I want to say next.
And that is like, bam, that will help me because it is not getting, like not drinking that Kool-Aid. And it doesn't do any good if I react. What does some good is if I show up with my consistent message about being living consciously, about being aware, about staying connected, more than addressing the weather. I love that answer. Of course I do. It's Seth. Okay, speaking of love, sounds like a love fest, Responsibility Day that came out on the 4th of July. and you characterize the 4th of July as being mischaracterized as a day of independence, and what actually matters is what we're going to do with it. And it inspired my thinking about this show and getting to talk with you about it. If we have the ability to change the culture, to connect with others, to make a ruckus, then yes, what we do with that is our responsibility as well. When I think about the ruckus I want to make and how can we, the ruckus makers, when it comes to preservation to this planet of ours, it's like I really want to ask, how can we make more of a ruckus? And here's my point. The United Nations latest report literally gives us a 12-year time span to turn the ship around, or we're going to start really frying. And as you know, if you live in sub-Saharan Africa today, you already are. Sure. Thousands of people die every day. And it begs the question to me, why aren't the planet preserver buses standing room only? Like, that's a thing. This is the UN that just did the science, reported
sure.
on
see,
it.
See, the problem is the story doesn't match how humans behave. We live in a country where people don't even get a flu shot. A flu shot is free. It has no side effects. And 8 weeks from now, you won't spend a week in bed thinking you're going to die. Or you won't die. That this seems like a fairly short time horizon. And yet, people don't get a flu shot. Right?
Right.
And
we can have a discussion about that another time.
But we also know that if you paste a picture of two eyeballs in the break room at work, fewer people will steal cookies from the cookie jar.
That is true. Yes.
All right. So what do we learn from these two things? What we learn is going to people and expecting them to act in rational, long-term, selfish interest is really, really hard. Really hard. On the other hand, peer pressure is overwhelmingly powerful. So what climate warriors need to do is focus 98.9% of their energy on one sentence. People like us do things like this. People like us do things like this. And that's why you don't see anybody wearing coats made from baby seal fur. Not because we could make a long, compassionate argument about baby seals, but because you know that if you wear a baby seal coat, you're going to be ridiculed, you're going to be shamed, and you're going to feel left out. Well, that behavior is called culture. Culture is people like us do things like this. And what needs to happen is less forensics debates and more of what's our standard? What is it like around here? What are we supposed to do when we're acting like our best selves? And when we model those behaviors and multiply those behaviors, then the word starts to spread. And so there are lots of ways that we can build honest, true, powerful stories around this issue that don't involve long UN reports, but instead involve keying into the stories we already tell ourselves. So a couple of examples that I've said out loud before. First of all, global warming is a terrible name because global is good and warming is good. So global warming must be fine. What we really have a problem with is atmosphere cancer. Because the atmosphere is a scientific structure, and cancer is something everyone knows and is afraid of. Chronic degenerative disease, it keeps getting worse until you do something about it. There are no cancer deniers. And if we are suffering from atmosphere cancer, then the question is, how do we get leaders and actresses and actors and influencers of both genders to shave their heads, because that's what people with cancer have to do. And what does it look like when you look around and all of these people are shaving their head? What story do we tell ourselves when we start acting like a community of people that are struggling to find intervention in a hurry, because otherwise the cancer is going to get worse? What do people like us do in the face of that imminent crisis? That's storytelling. It's all still true, but it feels fundamentally different than a bar chart.
And what a story when you say that. And I don't think I've ever read that with what you've written. And how do you think that lands with me and helps me to go forward? I mean, I'm just going to ask our listeners to sit with that and think about what you just said, because you're right. And not only that, there is atmospheric cancer, but because of that, there's lots of people shaving their heads because they have cancer.
Right, but it's also cancer.
Yes, yeah. There's cancer. So it's really, when you talk about stepping up and knowing that someone you love is going to have it or has it, that's a profound statement. And I don't know, I'm just saying right now, I'm not sure if I'm going to shave my head, but it's food for thought. I mean, that would be pretty darn bold, but it's just, like I said, I hope people will sit with that and really change it. I wish Paul Hawken, who says we should call it global warming because the climate's always changing. Well, when I talk to him again, I'll share that with him. I'm serious, because that's what we need to get people's attention. And it's a perfect segue to fear. In Linchpin, you talk about the lizard brain and not to listen to our lizard brain. So I'd like you to just address fear for a bit, our lizard brain, because to me, fear is what can shut us down easiest and fastest, and if we listen. So I'm always telling, sometimes I literally say, will you just shut up and go away, because I'm not listening to that anymore. It's never going to go away. Thanks, Seth.
That's okay. everyone who's figured out how to survive in the world has survived because of fear. Fear has upsides. But fear that's confused keeps us from doing the right thing. You can't make the fear go away, but you can dance with it. You can use it as a compass. So if you feel a fear of public speaking, but you know that public speaking isn't dangerous, then every time you get afraid to speak in public, you should listen to that fear and speak in public, because it's telling you something important, which is that this is a moment for you to do something, even though it's uncomfortable. So you get in the habit of listening to the fear and doing the opposite. There are times when that will really help. Don't do it when it says don't play in traffic. It's right. You shouldn't play in traffic. But when it comes time to do this leadership and connection work, it's so important. When the lizard shows up, you say, thank you. Great. I appreciate you pointing that out to me.
And the other thing when you say that we can't forget, like there's fear, and I love the book, Face Your Fears and Do It Anyway. It's like, yeah, just do it. I take a deep breath. You wouldn't believe some of the woo-woo things I do with, you know, saging myself and great sprays that I put on that smell really good. And it's like, yeah, go out there and rock it, Gina. So you're right. Just keep doing it. Don't let it shut you down. But the other thing that I think is important, and you have it, and I know I have it, is humor. We forget that humor can really go a long way. And I have an example. I met with the head of facilities management at the University of Arizona, and he's respected in the entire country about what they're doing with sustainability at the U of A. And he walks into this meeting with me, and I know him, because you have to know your audience. And I looked at him and I said, Chris, really? Wow. You showed up to a meeting with me and you're holding a plastic bottle, and everybody cracked up. First of all, they knew I had the relationship with him. I wasn't trying to embarrass him.
Sure.
So the next meeting he had, he walks in with the same people and he has this great reusable U of A bottle, and he shows it to everybody. He goes, huh? So, see, I can learn. And he said, we don't use plastic bottles around here anymore because Mrs. Green might catch us. But I think we have to remember that humor can be such an effective way to inspire people and get them to think about making some changes. So we're about up, but I have to ask you one more question if you're down for one more question.
One more.
One more. Education needs to be inconvenient. Education is under attack in our country. It hit the mark. It needs to be inconvenient because it relies on effort and discomfort to move us from where we were to where we want to be. So just tie it in, if you can, with the basis for why the planet, do you believe the planet is in the shape it is right now because it's inconvenient for it not to be? Everything's about ease and disposing. And, you know, how can we knock people on the head and say, embrace your discomfort, be one with your discomfort and start changing things.
Yeah, I don't think you can. I think you can get enrollment first. You can find people who say, over there, I want to go over there. So if someone wants to be a doctor, I can get them to enroll in medical school. And then once they're enrolled in medical school, I can help them understand that it's inconvenient to do an autopsy on a cadaver, but you have to if you want to graduate. But you can't walk up to someone on the street and tell them they have to do an autopsy because they're not enrolled in the journey. So we have to begin with the enrollment before we run ahead to the inconvenient part.
Got it. Get people to, I got it. And of course, I thank you. The time flew for me. It was delightful.
It was great.
And thanks for showing up in my life every day. And please keep on showing up for a very long time.
I'll do my best. You too. Good luck with the 10-year plan.
Thanks, Seth. Everybody stay with me. I'd like to close this out. And how great was that, getting a chance to hear and spend time with, certainly he's my number one in terms of mentoring and being a role model for how I want to show up in the world, and I hope you liked it. So I'd like to close with quoting one stanza from a poem, If, by the amazing poet Rudyard Kipling, because his words of wisdom ring so true for me now more than ever before in my lifetime. And on those rare days when I actually read the news or watch one of the constantly streaming news station, I wonder if I am keeping my head. So let me close with this. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. So that's just one stanza. And here's to each of us not losing our heads, trusting ourselves when others doubt us, being willing to wait, not giving way to hating, and in the meantime, doing whatever we can to work towards a more sustainable and socially just planet. Let's all get on the right bus on behalf of Mother Earth, and I thank you so sincerely for being a part of Mrs. Green's World Tribe. Make it a great green day.